I'm Dan Gottlieb. Welcome to Voices in the Family. Today's show is taped, so don't call in, but it's packed with three interviews. We're going to talk with a CEO whose life was turned upside down when he was convicted of a securities misdemeanor, and how his way of coping brought him to his life's purpose, helping other inmates and veterans. And another yoga instructor finds it's helpful in treating people with eating disorders. But first, both of these yoga teachers experienced a calling. So let's turn to David Yaden. He's a research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania in the Positive Psychology Center. His work centers on the study of miracles, actually, and he's written Being Called: Scientific, Secular, and Sacred Perspectives. David Yaden, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
How did you get into this business, this sacred perspectives?
Well, it started with my own experience. And so this was the first year of college, and I had, lying on my dorm room bed, a spontaneous experience that I can only really describe as spiritual, even though now I take an agnostic perspective in general to what occurred. So after this experience, it transformed me so much. It opened me to the world and other people, but it also just left me wondering what just happened to me. And so my research has been driven by that question.
So what did happen to you? Do you mind going into it, telling us about it?
Sure. So as I said, I was lying in my dorm room bed. It was a somewhat dark and directionless period in my life overall, but I always think of the experience as coming on spontaneously. It started as a warmth in my chest, and at first I thought it was heartburn. You know, I'd had cafeteria food, always a little suspect. So that warmth started to spread over my chest and eventually over my entire body. And at some point, a voice in my mind said, "This is love." At that point, I went into my mind or out of my body and experienced boundaryless horizons in every direction. And I just felt part of this intricate fabric. And that feeling of love just boiled over. And so when I opened my eyes, I was laughing and crying at the same time, which was unusual for me, and still is. And so that experience really changed my life. It was a real inflection point. And ever since, I've wanted to explore what happened to me in that moment.
Would you call that a transcendent experience?
I would. There's an issue with nomenclature. There's so many names for these experiences. You know, William James called them religious. People call them spiritual. John Haidt calls them self-transcendent. Maslow called them peak experiences. There's a number of names for this general type of experience.
Probably Freud would have said it's something that needs to be worked through and cured.
Yeah, Freud thought these were instances of pathology.
Yeah.
You know, oceanic feelings of oneness or regressions to the womb.
Did you think there was something wrong? How did you understand this?
Well, that really informs a lot of my work as well, because I didn't have the language to understand what happened to me, and it didn't seem clear where I could get that. And so I think a lot of people who have these experiences, their first thought is, am I going crazy? And so a lot of my work, I think, is motivated by telling people that they're not alone. You know, Gallup polls say that about 1 in 3 people report intense spiritual experiences of some kind. And so the book was about scientists and scholars describing their experiences and interpreting those experiences using their own theoretical background and scientific discipline.
So your transcendent experience turned into a calling.
It did.
You've talked about callings being critical in one's life, or suggested that people with a calling tend to be happier?
Well, I don't think that they're critical. I'm more interested in describing the phenomenon than saying that one ought to have a calling. You know, there are definitely downsides to having a calling. People with a calling tend to work much more. They tend to be more prone to be obsessed with their work or their calling. And so there are definite downsides, and there's no reason why people who don't feel as though they have a calling think that they should have one. I'm more interested in just describing what's going on with those of us that feel as though we do.
So what's going on?
Well, there's a few different ways of thinking about callings, and this is important. Amy Wisniewski works on callings as meaningful work. And so people who just view their work as very meaningful, there's also a more experiential sense of calling. And this comes in chronic and acute forms. You know, some people feel this transcendent pull over the years as if they're meant to do something. And finally, maybe they direct their lives in that direction, whereas other people have these road to Damascus type moments, these like I did, these experiences that come all at once, and it's an inflection point in their life is forever changed afterwards.
Yeah, I had something similar when I was 12 years old, and I first learned about psychology, psychotherapy. And I remember standing in the playground, middle school, kids are playing box ball or whatever, and I put my right foot back on the chain link fence as I leaned on the chain link fence, and I prayed to God, a God I don't believe in now, but I did then, and I said, make me a great psychotherapist, and I will do anything to get there. 12 years old, and I never looked back.
Wow, so it's sort of locked in that aspiration, that intention.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just stuck. You know, I'm hopeless here. You know, too late to find another career. But is this the kind of thing that you're finding when you study people who've had these transcendent experiences?
Definitely. You know, that's a story that we hear very often. A number of psychologists in the book talk about how they had these momentary experiences that changed their lives forever and brought them into a particular discipline. In this case, many of them are psychologists. And so I think a lot of psychologists and psychotherapists view their work as a calling.
Yeah.
Deeply
yeah.
meaningful.
Yeah, and a blessing. I mean, you hear that from doctors, but you don't hear that from a lot of lawyers. You don't hear it from blue-collar workers.
You know, there's a lot of interesting studies looking at a number of different disciplines, and the rate of how many people consider their work a calling per industry, I don't know. But I know it's relatively stable, and it's about 20 to 30% of people. And, you know, this is Amy Wisniewski's work, but she looks at janitors in hospitals and finds that those who view their work as a calling are doing things like putting flowers in people's rooms, walking them out to the car, and they view their work, they call themselves a healer, even though what they're doing is janitorial and not usually thought of in those terms. And so, you know, I think that many teachers, engineers, firefighters, doctors, you know, really across the board, there are people who feel called to a particular path.
Well, one of the things I'm hearing is, as you're talking, is self or other. I mean, especially when you talked about the janitor, it's of service to other. And I think those of us who have a calling, often it's about other and not about me or me being big or better or smarter. It's about serving others.
You know, and that's the crucial point. That's what's so fascinating from a research perspective about these experiences. It's all kinds of interventions in psychology that have such a small effect. These moments can be truly transformative. They can really change the way someone acts, and it's often in the direction of altruism and feelings of connection to other people. And we see that on the social level, but we also can see it in the brain. And so research where monks and nuns are put in an fMRI scanner and they're feeling these states of unity, the region of the brain that tends to model self and other boundaries is conspicuously quiet. It's inhibited. And so when people who are having these experiences say, I felt this sense of connection, this sense of unity with other people or the environment or a sense of the divine, it makes good neurological sense why they would be saying that's so.
And it also sounds very similar to your transcendent experience in college.
Yes, and this is Andrew Newberg's work and my experience.
Tell us about Andrew Newberg briefly and his work at Penn here.
Yeah, he's a neuroscientist who studies spiritual experiences, and so he's done a number of studies and is still doing them, putting people who have recently had spiritual experiences in the scanner, people who are going on a spiritual retreat and putting them in the scanner, and people who are veteran contemplatives who are able to put themselves into these states with some ease.
So when you talk about veteran contemplatives, you're talking about monks or nuns or long-term meditators.
Exactly, people who are praying or meditating for hours a day for many years.
You know, you talked about your experience that you labeled love, and we know through certain forms of meditation, I'm sure prayer, that can be cultivated, that we can teach our brains to do that. I'm thinking of what's called a metta meditation, a loving kindness meditation, wishing only for happiness for yourself, for your loved ones, for the larger community, and for the world. And that can be cultivated and nurtured, and I'm sure that does the same thing to the brain that was happening to your brain in college.
Yes, there are a number of common psychological concepts that we talk about all of the time that have this sort of self-transcendent element, that feeling of transcending the boundaries between self and other, which often comes with that feeling of love, you know, things like mindfulness, flow, awe, all the way up to very intense mystical types of experience. And yes, there's a number of ways that we know that these experiences can be triggered. Prayer, meditation, retreat environments.
I remember, you know, some of the times recently, I have experienced that awe. I was in South Africa. I was lucky enough to be sitting on a helicopter on top of a glacier. In Alaska, all by myself. The rest of my party left, which is what I wanted, you know. And I experienced awe. But one of the things about awe is myself, Dan, my sense of me shrunk to a point of irrelevance. Like there was no me watching. You know, it was me being a small and irrelevant part of something much bigger than me, and something I didn't understand and didn't care to. I just wanted that experience, and there was no me, no self in that moment.
Yes, Jonathan Haidt and Dr. Keltner both work on the emotion of awe, and that's truly a paradigmatic self-transcendent experience, and it's one that is accessible to really anyone given the right circumstances.
So I want to come back to the issue of calling that you wrote about extensively in your book, and what makes it interesting to you, important, and is it necessarily a religious concept?
Well, I'll start with the last thing you said first, because it's definitely not necessarily a religious concept. And that was in large part the point of the book, to get together a number of a spectrum of perspectives, from atheist to agnostic to spiritual but not religious to a variety of different religions. And what's so amazing is that people of all belief systems report these experiences, even though they interpret them in very different ways.
What is the relationship between having a calling and well-being? Is there one?
There certainly is. So this is the real interest of Martin Seligman, who says that positive psychology loves callings because callings are such a reliable way of increasing well-being at work and at home, as well as really contributing to other people and serving others in the world.
Does everyone have one that needs to be discovered?
No, I don't think so. I think there are many ways by which one can have well-being, and a calling is something particular. You know, I think it's far more prevalent than we suppose because people don't feel as though they can talk about these experiences in our society. But I don't think that people who don't have a calling need one by any means.
So you appear to me to be a young man, and this happened in college, and this is what you were called to do as a result. Are you comfortable now at this stage of your career that you have some, all of the answers you were looking for?
Not even close. This is a calling.
Damn.
No, this is something that continues to inspire me to want to do work and collaborate with other amazing researchers who are doing work on this topic. And I would be happy to contribute just one small step in towards understanding these experiences.
What's David Yeadon and this work look like 10 years from now?
Well, I think that 10 years from now, it will be a much more open topic of discussion culturally as well as scientifically. Culturally, I think that people will discuss these experiences more. The book describes a group format called Mystics Anonymous, which is sort of a tongue-in-cheek group format where people can share their experiences.
So the hope is that 10 years from now, it won't have to be anonymous anymore.
Precisely.
Yeah, exactly. David Yeadon, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's really fascinating stuff.
Thanks for your interest, Dan.
That's David Yeadon, a research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania in the Positive Psychology Center. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear from two people who have been called to teach yoga and have discovered its powerful effects on eating disorders as well as the prison population. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Intervention Associates, a subsidiary of Friends Life Care Partners, supports WHYY, a nonprofit, Quaker-based organization. Intervention Associates provides care management and guardianship services for people of all ages. Services include home care, community services, crisis intervention, and patient advocacy. Intervention Associates navigates all available healthcare options and medical benefits. Clients receive a professional needs assessment and detailed care plan. Information at interventionassociates.org.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We'll be talking with Michael Huggins. He's the executive director of the Transformational Yoga Project. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan.
Well, Mike, you started practicing yoga to help with some back pain, but after that you developed some legal problems and spent some time in prison. Mind telling us briefly what happened?
It's hard to tell in a brief story, but I certainly will. So the company that I used to work for, actually I had left that company, and I was with another company, and they became embroiled in a legal proceeding with the government. And ultimately, I was charged, along with three others, with what they call off-label marketing promotion of a medical device, and ultimately sentenced to a 9-month prison sentence.
Prison?
Prison, yeah. And not only that, was the day I was sentenced, the judge decided that I should serve my time immediately. So I was taken away in shackles in front of a crowded courtroom and processed right in Philadelphia at the Federal Detention Center, where I spent about 5 weeks before I was transferred to another prison.
Wow. So you carried your yoga practice, obviously, with you into prison. Did it help?
It did. It was, it was life-changing in so many ways, Dan. I didn't intend to start a yoga practice in prison, but I did intend to keep yoga practice within myself as a way to expand my practice. I thought this would be an opportunity for me to practice yoga, as we say, off the mat, in the real world.
How did it help?
Well, it helped on several levels. I'd say, firstly, on an emotional level, during the actual sentencing hearing itself, it was very uncomfortable, and it was very difficult to hear all the things that were being said, whether I agreed or disagreed with them. And part of our yoga practice, at least we believe in, is yoga is trying to find comfort in a uncomfortable situation. And so even then, I tried to calm myself down by saying, okay, let me take this all in and experience it. And then once that happened, as I got processed through the Federal Detention Center in Philadelphia, I did that to calm myself down as I was put through a situation that I had never experienced before, very uncomfortable, both physically and emotionally. So it started out as a practice to find some release and to just de-stress and basically to just survive in that situation.
I want you to be a little more specific. You used yoga to calm yourself down in a situation that, my God, is beyond stressful. I want to know exactly how you used that. Like, what happened to your mind, body, and what were you doing?
Well, that's a great question. And what I would tell you, what we have a tendency to do in our lives, at least in my life particularly, prior to this, would be when we're in a stressful situation or something bad happens, we tend to block it out. We just don't want to deal with it. And some of it's part of that fight-or-flight response, I think, that we deal with any time we're faced with some type of traumatic situation. Our yoga practice tries to do the opposite. Instead of blocking out what you're experiencing, I say we lean into that experience, meaning that we become fully aware of what's going on around us, both our external environment and inside, what's going on inside of us. Are we sweating? Is our breathing fast? Is our heart racing? Taking that all in, and if you become aware of that physically, emotionally, mentally, even spiritually from that point of view, you can then make some decisions. We might say you have a little more emotional intelligence to put it all in perspective and regulate yourself in, I think, a positive way.
Okay. So you take this practice into prison with you. What did your fellow inmates think? I mean, federal prison, you know, the one here in Philadelphia, it's a pretty tough place.
Yeah. And so in the prison system, particularly at the Federal Detention Center, there are no recreation areas. There's a little open space where there's actually a half basketball court, but it's uncovered. So, and I was sentenced in the beginning of the winter season, so it was very cold, and it was all blocked in with barbed wire. So there wasn't really much to do. We were all in one unit, if you will. So all the inmates there try to do anything they can to keep themselves physically fit. They will use stairs, they'll use whatever they can to do chin-ups, push-ups, because there's just no equipment to use. And I started doing some basic core work, if you will, and people were curious to say, hey, that's pretty neat. He's not using any kind of equipment. And so eventually
two
of the inmates came to me and asked me what I was doing.
Let me interrupt you. So what does it look like when you say core work? I don't picture you sitting on a mat.
Well, there's no mats, that's for sure. So
right. What
I would tell you is, when I first started it, I would call it more like yoga lattes, in the sense that it wasn't doing traditional yoga poses, because I just didn't want to put myself in that situation where where I would stand out and say, "What the heck is this guy doing?" It's not the place where you want to do that. And so what I was doing would be more work on your core. They would be, you know, crunches, but they would be in a more controlled way. So not just beating your body up, but in a controlled stretching way, but in a very physical way. And very quickly, several people came up to me and asked me what I was doing, and they said, "Can you train me?" And I said, "I'd be happy to," you know. And so that just sort of grew from a grassroots of showing them some basic core work strength poses, if you will, to ultimately moving into a more of a traditional type of yoga practice once they understood what was going on and they were participating and asking for more and more.
So what did that look like physically, and what impact was it having on the inmates?
So physically, one story I would tell you, one young inmate was there, and he was there actually for murder and couldn't make bail. And so I didn't know all this at the time, but he said, "Hey, you know, can you give me six-pack abs?" And I said, "I don't know if I can give you six-pack abs, but I can de-stress you a little bit, I think." And so from this particular fellow, young man, he took to yoga that just incredibly, and very quickly we moved from the physical attributes of doing the different poses, kind of strength poses, to doing more mindfulness kinds of things, holding poses longer. And then at the end of these sessions, we would do a version of a meditation, and they loved it. You would think maybe not so much there, but that was the highlight of the sessions. After we would do we call it an asana practice, a physical movement of yoga, for maybe 45 minutes to an hour. We would then lie in a restful position, no mats or anything, just on the cement floor, for probably 15 minutes, and just in silence as best we could. Of course, it was noisy in the prison,
sure.
But that was the beginning of them understanding that there was more to yoga than just the physical movement.
Tell me about trauma and yoga, yours,
trauma,
theirs.
So that's at the core of what we're doing at Transformation Yoga Project. And trauma is at the core, I would say, of virtually everybody that's in prison, or people dealing with post-traumatic stress, or even people dealing with addiction, which is the core groups that we work with. So trauma, essentially, in my mind, is a lack of safety. And when we're in a traumatic situation, our brain and our body moves into this fight or flight response. And when the body is not allowed to fight or flight because you just can't escape it, then that trauma, we believe, gets imprinted into your body and into your mind somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can imagine people who are suffering from post-traumatic stress, they're in a war situation, and they can't leave. They're watching them friends, or maybe they're doing things that are very traumatic. The same is true with people in prison. And in the prison situation, a lot of the guys have had what I call acute trauma, where they might have experienced violence or been involved in violence, or maybe they've had chronic trauma in that they've been brought up in a very difficult environment, family, household, maybe in disarray or violence, and so they've grown up with this chronic trauma, and it gets imprinted into their brain. And we follow a lot of what Dr. Wessel van der Kolk's worked on about this idea that the issues are in the tissues, and so we believe that the traumatic events gets imprinted into our bodies.
So what does yoga do to help release them? And, I want a concrete example here. Can you give me an example of one of them you work with?
Let me give you a great example. This is not necessarily one from prison, but this is from some of the work we do at the VA hospital. There is a veteran there, and this fellow is in amazing shape, and I'm going to call him Jorge, just to pick a name. That's not his real name. And Jorge served numerous terms over in Iraq and came back at the VA hospital with severe post-traumatic stress. He came to the yoga classes there and came week after week, and we saw the transition from him from a physical practice to more of a mental practice, where he got in more into meditation, calming himself down, and then eventually he was able to be released for a weekend pass to go see his family. And so he was at the bus stop waiting for the bus, and he relayed the story where another guy got in, to his words, got in his face, and they were about to get into a fight. And Jorge looked at himself. He was standing in tall, and we call that mountain pose. His chest is proud, his shoulders were down, and he was breathing. He looked at himself and said, "Wait a second, I'm standing in this pose, and this pose is a strong but relaxed pose." So he took a deep breath, he released his breath, and he let that moment go, that instant where his mind was going to take over his body, and he released it. And he said, "You know, that moment passed, and I got through that moment. I was able to go home, and I had several of the similar kind of moments with my family." And he said, "I did the same thing. I was able to let that moment pass, and I had a very good weekend with my family."
Well, you are right. That was an excellent example. That's a great story. Could you just tell us briefly how you're doing today?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking, because it's been certainly a journey for me, and one that I hadn't expected to take. So I became a yoga instructor at the age of 52, when all this was changing, and some people would say that's sort of crazy, and you know, I'm sort of remaking myself. And as I evaluate all of this, I'm not remaking myself. I'm essentially being who I really have been all along, and so I'm doing incredibly well. I feel like I'm where I should be, even though I had a lot of education to be a business person. I feel I'm where I should be, and where I'm part of my journey. All the experiences I've had up to this point have got me to where I need to be right now. Sort of, if you believe in how the universe works and all that brings together, I really believe that's where I should be. And so I'm doing fantastic. I'm doing what I love. I'm doing somewhat uncomfortable, particularly talking about the legal experience. So I'm trying to practice leaning into that discomfort rather than just act like it never happened. So it's all part of what we try to bring to the populations that we serve as the organization that we established.
Well, I've got to tell you, as a fellow human and one who inhabits this planet with you, I'm sure glad you're here doing the work you're doing, Mike. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you for having me, Dan.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. That was Michael Huggins. He's the executive director of the Transformational Yoga Project. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Dr. Maynard Herlin from the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. Our Melanoma Research Center brings together scientists with diverse skills and knowledge to develop new treatments for this deadliest of all skin cancers. In the last 4 years, 6 new treatment strategies have helped revolutionize outcome for patients. We are committed to finding the cure. Learn more at wistar.org. My name is Maynard, and I'm Wistar Science.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today's show's taped, so don't call in. But we've got some food for thought and some yoga exercises for you to try. My guest is Sarah Joy Marsh, a yoga teacher and therapist. Her book is Hunger, Hope, and Healing, and offers a program to address food-centered behaviors and body image issues. Sarah Joy, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
So let's start with the big picture. Okay, current research suggests that much of dietary eating problems are in the brain, and that the brain often doesn't have a shut-off valve. So people really don't know when they're sated. So clearly biology and genetics play a major role in eating disorders. So where does yoga fit in and how?
Well, one of the benefits of yoga is how during the practice itself, you cultivate certain brain functions, such as one we call in the contemporary neuroscience world, interoception. And interoception is, I describe to my students, something like internal proprioception. It's the ability to sense when your body is hungry or full, warm or cold, to feel your muscles and sensations from the inside, to experience your heart rate going up or down, and know that it's either from exercise or relaxation or a stressful thought or interaction.
Well, now, wait a minute. In order to do that, one actually has to sit down and do nothing and kind of reflect about what's happening inside their body. That's a lot to ask.
Well, which is actually why we don't ask our students right away to sit down, be still, and potentially feel restless and uncomfortable. We teach them, and in my private practice when I work with people in my counseling work, I'm teaching them to move, to breathe, and what I say to them often after the yoga exercise is, and now feel the echo of that experience in your body on the inside. So once there's a little bit of movement, they can be still.
Explain that echo.
Yeah, when we've been doing a yoga practice, for example, you stretch your muscles, you move the joints, you breathe more deeply into your lungs, and your body has to circulate, innervate, and tend to those movements. Your brain is taking this information in all the time from the outside world and from the inside world. So the echo after the yoga practice, even if it's just one yoga pose, the echo is like a warm or tingle sensation where there's been some movement, or a greater sense of ease in the breath, in the belly, in the diaphragm.
Hmm. Is that the kind of thing that happens? I have many of my patients take a deep, deep, deep breath and hold it at the top of the in-breath for a second and then just let go. And the whole body changes there and the parasympathetic nervous system takes over. And
yes.
We let go of everything. Is that what you mean by the echo?
That's a part of the echo. It comes from a deep breath or from moving a muscle or from experiencing a sensory thing like listening to sound, but hearing the sound on the inside, not just on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Joy, you talk a lot about self-nurturing, and we've got to be careful here because you're talking about eating here, and self-nurturing is not to be confused with self-indulgence.
Right.
So explain.
Yeah, most of my students and clients had a deficit in earlier life of learning how to self-nurture. In the absence of that, people end up either sort of over-disciplining themselves, which I call rigid strategies like a certain diet paradigm, or we can end up over-indulging and not knowing when we're full or not knowing what foods are really suited to care for the body. So people can vacillate between significant deprivation, rigid discipline, or overindulgence that feels like a reward, but then goes out of control. And neither of those strategies is actually nurturing.
Clearly. I just want to clarify something about people with eating disorders. You said most of your patients experience some kind of deprivation in their childhood. And I just want to be careful here because that's kind of a generalization. That's not universally true necessarily, although it is true for many. But, you know, for some it's genetic. For some it's, and you know this, Irijoy, secondary to trauma.
Yeah, and so what I say, rather than deprivation, just to clarify, when I'm talking with my students, I'm pointing to the deficit we might have experienced in early life in terms of learning skills, like how to self-nurture. So even if we're born with a genetic disposition that might lean us towards difficulty knowing what our appetites are, in an environment where we're learning skills from parents or care providers or teachers or community members, we can internalize skills to help us navigate what our genetics happen to be. But most of my clients didn't get those skills, so by the time they come to see me, they might have had 10, 20, 30 years of dysregulation in their appetite and their body, and a real sense of loss about how to adopt life skills that could help them.
I want to ask you something about the brain-body connection. I've been under the weather, and I've been confined to bed for the bulk of the past month, about 18, 20 hours a day.
Oh.
And I've had this craving for carbohydrates. And I'm really good about my diet, but I've had this craving for comfort foods. And, you know, you look at it on a psychological level, and it makes sense. But if you look at it on a physical level, I'm laying in bed there and I'm burning even less calories than I already do. So what's that disconnect there?
Well, sometimes I talk with my students about the limbic brain, also called the mammalian brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I call the dog and cat brain, because our pets have mammalian brains also. And I think we do see with other mammals that part of how we soothe ourselves is with connection and with food. And so if you've been, hypothetically, if you've been in bed for the last month or so, 18 to 20 hours a day, I don't know how much connection you've had or how many hours of that time was spent alone, or if you might have touched into the isolation that human beings can feel so poignantly. And food is one of the ways we soothe that.
You talk a lot about hydration as I was reading some of your background and your book. Why?
Well, there's two reasons for that. Thanks for asking. Because on the one hand, I want to give a person a quote-unquote homework assignment when they leave their counseling session with me or in the group therapy that I do. And I want the homework to be something they can accomplish and feel successful about. And if I start right away changing a person's food relationships and saying, these are foods you can eat, these are ones you can't eat, which goes into good and bad categories for food and black and white thinking, which I tend to stray away from. If I give them the basic assignment to hydrate, we will both pretty promptly understand this student's relationship to self-care and to self-nurturing discipline.
How so?
Well, if they remember to do it, if they forget to do it, if they do it once and then forget the rest of the day, if they have two good days and then three bad days and then one good day, we start to see what their rhythm is in terms of remembering to prioritize themselves and their care. And it's also the case that hydrating your brain and body is really essential to mood balancing and brain function and musculoskeletal ease. When our bodies are dehydrated, we have a whole host of symptoms that might be solved by hydrating, such as muscle aches and pains, joint pain, headaches, sometimes anxiety.
Yeah, I think most of us probably walk around being at least partially dehydrated. So, speaking of homework, let's give our listeners and this host some homework. I mean, I know this is difficult on the radio, and yoga is kind of a visual kind of thing, but give us some homework. What can we do?
Well, one of the first practices in my book I call stretching to dissolve fear, because on the one hand, fear is promoting most of our addictive behaviors in terms of how it escalates our brain chemistry. And on the other hand, recovery can seem scary. So I start in my book with this practice called stretching to dissolve fear. And to do it, a person can be sitting or standing. and you interlace your fingers. Then you turn the heels of the hands inside out and stretch the arms first forward. So the shoulder blades widen on the upper back, and you can take a deep breath down below the belly button. And then you would take the arms up overhead, and as you're stretching them up overhead, the thoracic spine comes into a little bit of extension, so your posture might feel more upright. The rib cage lifts away from the hips, and that makes a little more room for breathing, again, down below the diaphragm, below the belly button. So let's take about 4 deep breath cycles, slowly in through the nose and slowly out through the nose, while keeping the arms stretched to the best of your ability. And try to slow down the exhale especially, as it's going to slow down the nervous system towards the parasympathetic response. We'll just do one more breath cycle right through here, in through the nose and out through the nose. And then unclasp the hands and take the arms in a wide circle until they come down to dangle from your arms, which can dangle from your shoulders. And then just spend a few moments observing what I called earlier the echo of that experience in your body, your breathing, your mind, and potentially even in your brain. And because the way breathing is navigated either through the chest when we feel anxious or primarily through the diaphragm when we're able to feel relaxed, when we can initiate diaphragmatic breathing on our own, which this particular pose does, we can have a little leadership over where our brain goes between sympathetic toggle or parasympathetic response.
Well, that was really helpful, and I hope my listeners come back and listen to that exercise again and again. Probably even better would be to read your book. I've got to tell you, Sarah Joy, I was watching my producer engage in these exercises, and we'll have to find out afterwards if she is feeling better than she was a few minutes ago. She's nodding her head yes. Larry, you actually helped my producer, Larry, to feel better, something I've been trying to do for years and failed. So congratulations. I want to... You talk about being comfortable with being uncomfortable, and I think that's really important, although it does sound contradictory. You know, I talk an awful lot about, you know, what I've learned over the years is that real strength, and people talk a lot about being strong, that real strength is when you're comfortable with your weakness.
Yeah. And so, you know, earlier I said most of my clients, when they come to see me, had a deficit of developing what I call essential life skills. And for recovery, one of those essential life skills is called getting comfortable feeling uncomfortable. And partly, we have to acknowledge that discomfort is how the human body can experience growth. Like when our baby teeth came in, and blessedly, none of us directly remembers our own experience of baby teeth. But if you've been a parent and you've been near an infant when baby teeth are coming in, you know there's context for that and there's purpose for it. And we try to soothe the baby as much as we can to tolerate the pain of teeth. Well, if it's the case that part of our biological growth requires some discomfort, like you exercise a muscle and it might hurt the next day a little bit, you know, wow, I exercise my muscle. It's also the case that our spiritual, mental, and emotional growth sometimes requires a bit of discomfort. We're going to stretch into areas that we haven't explored before, and that can produce a kind of discomfort for both engaging in greater competency and capacity and feeling like, do I deserve this? Or feeling the tenderness that's underneath our addictions or compulsions and apprehensions. So the bandwidth goes in both directions when we experience discomfort, like towards joy and elation and capacity, and also towards poignancy and tenderness.
You use the phrase, do I deserve this? And so many people you work with and I work with have this critical judge and feel that they don't deserve joy, respite, love, compassion. They feel they are lovable? How could I be loved when I eat so much or drink so much, or if I've had an affair or if I've done something illegal? How could I deserve kindness and goodness?
Yes. Yeah, I've certainly worked with hundreds of people around this question, and I like to tie it back to the instinct in the human system to experience shame and to misinterpret a moment of like humility or embarrassment or regret. We misinterpret it as shame internalized, rather than, well, here's a chance for me to understand myself better or to look at my human condition more kindly. Sadly, once we've internalized shame, it can really grow, I call it like the weeds in the garden of mind. It can overcrowd every other possible kind thought or compassionate thought or tender thought, because shame is so powerful, and we misinterpret that it's trying to motivate, shape, and help us. But shame can't be motivating because it's also terrifying. It makes the part of the brain that experiences fear get aroused. And once we're in that shame/fear arousal, it's really hard to think clearly, because actually quite literally the neocortex goes down in volume, goes offline, and the limbic brain says, wait, there's an actual emergency going on here. The emergency was my thoughts, but here it is.
So, Sarah Joy, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and thank you for the wonderful work you do, and your book was wonderful, Hunger, Hope, and Healing. I highly recommend it. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you very much for this time together.
All right. Take good care.
You too.
Bye-bye. On today's show, we heard from Sarah Joy Marsh, Michael Huggins, and David Yaden. We'll be back next week taking your calls. You can follow us on Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam. Help us get to 1,000 followers. Email us at voices@whyy.org. Well, the engineers for today's show have been Al Banks and Charlie Kyer. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Trin Thatch is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.